history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some people around you with some stories to tell. All we need to do is ask a few questions and take the time to listen. That's what we do each week on this program. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And the gentleman we're going to meet today is 92 years young, lives in Merced, California, originally from New Jersey, though. And boy, does he have some stories of flying Navy fighters, F-4U Corsairs, in the Pacific during World War II. Let's go way back, though. Walt Burr, growing up in Dover, New Jersey.
Right.
I've heard of Dover, England, Dover, Delaware. Where's Dover, New Jersey? What kind of place was that?
Well, small town, about 10,000 people then. An old town. It was there during the Revolutionary War, so it had an ancient history.
And you guys were aware of that as kids?
Probably not. We knew about it, but as kids, you're not interested in, you're interested in playing and sports and school to a certain extent.
Did you have brothers and sisters you had to try to keep up with?
No, it's the only child.
So what kind of tricks were you up to as a kid?
Well, not too much. We lived on the side of a mountain covered with trees, and we'd go out into the woods and have a good time.
I'm always fascinated to get different people's perspectives on this question. I've interviewed a lot of pilots over the years, fighter pilots, bomber pilots, transport pilots, you name it. And at some point, every one of them mentions catching the flying bug, that there was something that turned them on to this idea of aviation, and they could never shake it from that point on. Was there a moment like that for you, that you were turned on to this idea of flight?
Yes, I can't tell you when the moment occurred, but every time a plane went over, I had to look up at it, and I had never been in an airplane until I got in the Navy, but I always wanted to. Built model airplanes.
And you probably heard about people like Lindbergh and
pilots. Oh, yes, yes. Flight across the Atlantic was of great interest to a young boy,
sure.
Me, and lots of others.
Do you remember having an ambition or dream or goal in mind before the war came around?
No, not really.
You would have been 17 when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So would that have been your senior year of high school?
Or? No, I was going to Rutgers University studying agriculture.
So you'd already graduated high school.
Yeah.
You're off at college. Did you have any idea that a war could happen or would happen?
Oh, well, yes. On the East Coast, we were already having German submarines trying to sink the ships that we were sending to England. Even though we were not in the war,
right?
It was news in the newspapers on the radio. I don't think most of us realized what all was going on in Europe.
As far as the concentration camps?
Yes, mm-hmm. As far as that type of thing. You'd read the headlines about whatever the Germans had done or hadn't done or what the other countries were faced with, but I don't think that we really realized what the situation was. I think a lot of people didn't want to get involved in the war in Europe. We didn't envision a war in the Pacific. We were pretty far removed from what was going on over there and the Japanese invading China, and really didn't register in our normal day-to-day living.
So that must have been quite a jolt when you heard that news.
Oh, yeah.
You
yes.
Remember how you found out?
Yeah, I sure do. I was laying on my bed in the fraternity house listening to a pro football game from New York City around 1 o'clock in the East Coast, 7 o'clock in Hawaii. It got our attention big time.
So they interrupted the football broadcast with the news.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't tell you whether, I don't know that I finished listening to the game or whether it was still on, or it was a whole new subject of stuff to talk about.
And here you are in a fraternity house, plenty of guys to talk to about it,
I'm sure. Yes, yeah. I was a freshman. When I started my sophomore year, I found that the Navy, which I have to attribute my desire to get involved in the Navy, and I had a very good friend who was a retired lieutenant commander in the Navy who had come up through the hawse hole as an enlisted man. I was fascinated by his stories of old China Hand and all the going way back. So my thought was to get involved in the Navy, and when I found out that 2 years of school, the Navy would accept folks to try to enlist, which I promptly did, specifically as a cadet.
To fly.
To fly.
But you'd never been in an airplane before.
Never been in an airplane, no.
So what made you think that flying was the way for you?
I just knew that's what I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
If I could, and fortunately, I could.
Well, and that's not a given. A lot of guys tried and couldn't.
The Navy had an excellent program for training prospective pilots. Started us out with a CPT, civilian pilot training, flying Piper Cubs, still wearing our own clothes, but in the Navy.
Right. Was that a rush for you the first time you got up in the air?
Oh, yes. It was really a rush. The gentleman who ran the flight school that we were at in Ogdensburg, New York, was a chain smoker of cigars, and I'd never even thought about wanting to smoke. He took me up for my first flight and carried a box of cigars along with him and smoked in the airplane, puffing on his cigar, and it didn't bother me at all. I loved the plane, but that was my first flight.
So you were hooked?
Oh, yes. And we were flying on skis. It was winter in upper New York State. And plywood skis. Eventually they wore out. And they put the wheels on, and we flew off the ice with the wheels on.
Well, if you can fly off ice, then you can fly off an aircraft carrier, right?
Well, I guess.
No, there was a lot of levels of training, I'm sure, that occurred between those two bookends. Were there some moments along that way of training? Because I've heard a lot of stories from guys during this time, and we just kind of take it for granted now that, you know, planes take off carriers and they land on carriers. But this was so pioneering and revolutionary at the time. So many guys died just in training stateside along the way. Were there some moments along that journey of training that you said, boy, I don't really know what we're doing here. Should we really be doing it this way?
What I wanted to do is be able to do whatever it took to do it. An example, in primary training, flying N3Ns out of Glenview Naval Air Station, up for a check ride on acrobatics, and I wasn't doing slow rolls to the satisfaction of the instructor. He said, if you want to take an extra flight, I'll go up and do slow rolls and teach you. And I went up, and we did slow rolls for about an hour, do the rolls down and climb back up and do them again. And he found out what I was doing wrong and straightened it out. And anyway, I passed. Then we went on to a pre-flight ground school and physical, all kinds of sport, and long marches and obstacle courses and all kinds of things. And the Navy deliberately put a lot of pressure on you. If you couldn't take it, they washed out.
Right. You probably saw that happen to a lot of guys you knew.
Oh, yeah. So the pressure was there all the time.
What do you think it was about you that enabled you to handle that pressure and to perform under it?
Well, number one, I wanted to very badly. I did the best I could on whatever it was. Passed the ground school courses okay. Did all the physical stuff okay. For example, they had a 30-foot rope that you climbed hand over hand. You could use your feet, but if you could climb it with just your arms, they thought that was pretty good, and I could do that. They timed it, how long it took to do it, and I beat the time. All of it compounded, added up. I got through that phase and went on to further flight training.
Did you have an idea of what kind of plane you wanted to fly?
Oh, always wanted to be a fighter pilot. But again, you had no great choice in that. When you could ask for whatever you wanted, but that didn't mean you were going to get it. So after I went through all the cadet syllabus and got my wings and got commissioned as an ensign, they sent me to DeLand, Florida, to be a dive bomber pilot flying SBDs, which was a very nice, rugged, great plane. Then we moved into a newer plane, the Helldiver SB-2C, went to Hawaii, and by then the Navy needed more fighter pilots because of the kamikazes. I became very fortunate in that they moved me into Corsair, flying a Corsair F4U, and I was thrilled about that and just loved it. It was a great airplane to fly, and you just loved every minute of that.
I've got a couple questions on that. The SBDs and the SB-2Cs, as dive bombers, your role would have been a little different had you been deployed in those. And earlier on in the war, places like Midway, I mean, there were tons of these going in. Very hazardous job. But one, I'm sure the capabilities were different from those dive bombers to the Corsair. And also, if you had gone over in dive bombers, you're responsible for a gunner who's sitting behind you and facing the other way, right?
Right.
And the Corsair is just you.
Yeah, right.
Did you like that better, only being responsible for yourself instead of having another guy that you had to worry about?
Well, yes, not because I objected to the other guy back there, because he had his chores to do, one of them being calling off the altitudes as you did your dive bombing run so that you pulled out before you hit the ground.
That's kind of an important job.
Yeah, because you might, example, one of our guys in training dove into a lake. He didn't realize that he was going too low and just hit the water. And he had a gunner in the back seat who had never been up in a plane before. That was a young man's first flight.
Wow.
And he had just come. He asked the regular gunner, could he go up in his place? And he did. And
wow.
Anyway, they dove into the lake, and both were killed.
And I know that later on you'd see things that were just as bad or worse, but as a young pilot in training, to see something like that happen, that had to be hard.
It was, yes. But you just can't let it bother you like it would if you allowed it to. Realize that can happen to you just as easy as it happened to the van it happened to.
Is that something that the Navy prepared you for, dealing with death, or is that something that you just had to handle on the fly?
You just have to handle it. If you didn't know that that was a part of your daily life experiences and you were going to find it out by it happening, if you couldn't deal with it, why? And some people couldn't.
Sure.
No matter what you did during World War II, whether you were a fighter pilot or a cook in the galley on a ship, your life was on the line.
Absolutely. There were no safe jobs. So that move from a two-person plane to just you, even though you're not responsible for someone else, you lose a little bit of a safety net too, and then there's more that you have to stay on top of. I mean, you've got a lot to be responsible for.
Yeah. Yes, if you could do it, why, fine. If you couldn't, the Navy was going to find that out before you got into a combat situation.
And how about, can you quantify for us or at least describe the difference in power and aerobatic ability when you went from a dive bomber to that F4U? Was it a big step up?
Oh, yes. F4U could go about 440 knots, straight and level, full power. 3,600 horsepower. It was able to do all kinds of maneuvers. Dive bombers were rugged, but the SBD went maybe 170, something like that. SB-2C went a little faster than that, but the Corsair was built to stand a lot more stress than they were.
Would it be somewhat parallel to say that you kind of went from a checker cab to a Ferrari?
Well, yeah, but the dive bomber in its own function was built to do a straight down dive with dive brakes that opened up.
Right.
So you didn't go too fast. You could maneuver the plane around in the dive. Of course, you don't have a lot of time to do.
Yeah.
But it was just a different function.
Sure.
You know, you really were able to do so much more in the Corsair. We did dive bombing in it. You could put the main gear down as a dive brake, but we never did. We always dove clean. We'd start a run around 20,000 feet and pull out down around 2,000 or a little bit before. We'd be doing maybe 500 knots when we'd pull out.
You're pulling some G's there.
Yeah. Yes, and you get all gray, but if you pull that much, why, you were right on the ragged edge of maybe passing out.
That was my question. Were you ever afraid of that, that you might pass out on one of these runs?
Oh, yeah. You were not afraid, but conscious of when you start to pull and you start to get gray, let off the pull a little bit. Don't pull harder, pull easier. When you dove that distance and built up that speed, if you weren't pulling out by 2,000 feet, you were in trouble. One dive bombing practice run in Hawaii, I pulled too hard and grayed out, and when I came to, I thought I was still going down and pulled, but I was going up. I had pulled so hard, and I was in a cloud. I thought I was going down, and I pulled hard and did a loop and came out going straight towards the ground. and pulled out that. I never did that again.
Well, and you're lucky you had a chance not to do it again, because I'm just thinking there are probably guys killed with that very same confusion.
Well, yes. I lived through it and learned a lesson that I never let myself get in that position. When this was practice run in Hawaii, you're learning what to do and what not to do. And if you live through it, why, you learned.
And when you describe that graying out, most people haven't experienced that. Does your vision start to go dim? Does the blood rush from your face? Are you getting lightheaded? What is it?
Your blood rushes from your head.
Yeah.
And your eyesight goes. You go, in effect, you're blind. You're not really, really conscious. You're just, for a short time, you're out of it. But it's, you're talking about a fraction of a minute.
Uh-huh.
You're not talking about a long period of time.
It can still be long enough to kill you, but
yes.
I'm just trying to think of something to compare it to. Maybe it's kind of like taking a dimmer switch and taking it all the way to the off position.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it snaps back on.
Yeah, it comes back on. If you've ever been knocked out in the dentist's office to have a tooth pulled, you're there and then you're not there. And then you're there.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, the tooth has been pulled. You know, the people have had that. That's a pretty comparable.
And most of us are saying no thank you, right? It's time for our first break. But when we come back, we're going to dive into some of Walt Burr's Corsair missions in the Pacific in 1945. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 92-year-old Walt Burr, originally from New Jersey. He's made his home in Merced, California since 1951. Pay him a visit there, and you might convince him to show you the logbook he kept for 60 missions in F-4U Corsairs in the Pacific during World War II. And you'll probably see the photo you can also find at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, proving that this recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross can still fit into the jacket he wore in the cockpit more than 70 years ago.
So you get through all this training in the Corsair, and, you know, most people are familiar with that plane and the unique shape of its wings, and maybe they remember, you know, the TV show with the Pappy Boyington character flying all his F-4U Corsairs. The first time that you flew it in combat, do you remember that first mission?
Yeah.
And this is from the carrier USS Essex?
Yes.
Which is loaded not just with Corsairs, but all kinds of planes.
F-6Fs and Helldivers and torpedo planes.
What was that day like? Were you nervous, anxious?
Oh, yes. It was a pre-dawn launch, and I was carrying a 1,000-pound bomb, and I was on the catapult, and I had never been on a catapult, and I knew what was supposed to happen, but I had never been on a catapult, and I had never had a 1,000-pound bomb. I'd had practice bombs, little ones. On the Corsair, there was a little handle that could pull out, and when you shoved the throttle forward, your fingers could hook onto this thing so you could keep the throttle full on. Well, I was pushing the throttle forward, and I hadn't hooked it all the way on. It wasn't fully on, and they fired the catapult, and I wasn't ready. And my hand came off the throttle and went back and caught on something. So I had one hand to do everything and carrying this 1,000-pound bomb. But it flew, and I held it, and I got my hand out, and everything came out all right.
Well, you say that, but I'm sure that's not what it felt like at the time. So you're the hand that's supposed to hold on to that, because they fire the catapult when you're not ready. It gets thrown back and then hooked on something, so you can't get it free, and you're with the other hand trying to control the plane and make sure the throttle's on.
Right.
And probably feeling a little sense of panic.
Well, no, mad. I want to kill the officer, the guy that fired me off. I use that term literally. I didn't want to kill him, but I want to.
Sure. Everybody knows what you mean. If you saw him, you'd have a word for him.
Oh, I did when I got back.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah.
But first you had to fly this mission. Where were you? What was the target?
Japan, Kyushu.
And in fact, your group, that air group, did more damage to Japan in those next few months than any other air group, from what I understand.
Yeah, we did quite a bit. We did our share of bombing and strafing and whatever. We were on a dive bombing run on that first day. At first flight, we lost 3 pilots. Mm. And one of the reason we did is that some of us that were in that group had been trained as a dive bomber pilot, and we were now dive bombing in the Corsair. The dive bombing regime goes down one at a time following each other, and that's what we did. And the Japs jumped us when we were pulling out and all strung out and not able to defend ourselves for that brief period of time.
So after you make your dive and release your bomb and you're coming back out, they would swarm around you before you could get the other fighters to help?
Yeah, right. And after that, we went down in pairs. I would fly on somebody's wing, or somebody would fly on a wing on me. We'd go down, 2 of us. The one who was leading that 2-plane section would pick the target and go down, and you'd go down with them, and both of you would bomb the same thing at the same time.
And then you were there to protect each other after.
Yeah. The way we protected each other was a thing called the thatch weave. Instead of being up close like we were to the dive, we'd spread out the turning radius of the plane, and if a Jap jumped me, my partner would turn towards me and I'd turn towards him, and we'd do this a weave so that whoever was being attacked by the Jap would be attacked by my partner, or I would be attacking if the Japanese pilot had jumped my partner. I would turn towards him and he'd do the weave. We'd do the weave. That allowed us to shoot at the Jap.
gave you angles that you wouldn't have had.
Right.
But it also probably adds a little more danger to it if you're crossing paths at that high rate of speed with a third aircraft mixed in there, too.
Oh, yes. But that was great. We got to shoot at the Jap. And he didn't like that because they were good pilots and all, but they didn't have the armor plate and the self-sealing gas tanks that we had. You had some protection. Usually the Japanese didn't want to get involved with you once you were in the position to do that.
So the strength in numbers was a deterrent.
Right.
And sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you earlier. As you're talking about that first mission where three of the pilots didn't make it back, as you make that dive, again, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes and imagine what that feels like. I mean, you're feeling the forces of a high-speed dive. You said earlier 500 knots.
Well, when you're pulling out, yeah. It started at 150 or 200.
But you're going down. You've never done this for real before. You've got a 1,000-pound bomb. And you got to know when to release it, when to pull up. You don't know who's shooting at you. How do you stay focused in that moment? What are the things that are going through your mind?
Well, you just focus on what you're doing. You don't worry about anything else. If I'm flying on someone's wing, I stay there and we know what both of us are going to do. And when it's time to release the bomb, we do it together, pull out together and immediately move it out into the position to weave.
But on that first mission, you didn't have that.
No.
It's just you.
Yeah.
So how do you know when to release that bomb?
I know what I'm aiming at. I know what altitude I'm at. And I've practiced with practice bombs. The same thing. You just hit the old button and it goes.
So you let it go. Then you start to pull up.
Yeah.
Are you aware while you're still in the air of whether or not your bomb hit the target?
No, not right then. No, you're not going to see it.
Later on when you land, you get a report?
Yes, and you do see what the other guys have done, and the other guys see where yours went. Maybe. You don't know really whose it was.
And you mentioned the three pilots from your group that didn't come back that day. When did you figure that out? Did you see any of that happen, or is that something you learned upon return?
Learned upon return.
And did anybody shoot at you on that first mission?
Well, I guess they did, but I didn't know. They didn't hit me.
Yeah.
You know, you have to keep in mind that all this happens at a rather fast pace. When you get back to the ship and you talk about it, you ask, did you see Smitty go down or whatever? Maybe you saw it and maybe you didn't. You know, you don't hang around to see what you did.
Yeah, or else you won't be around to do another one. But when you did get back to your ship and you found out that those three planes were missing, that those three friends of yours?
Oh, yes.
You don't know if they're coming back? How did you deal with that?
I really can't tell you. You just knew that it could happen, and it happened, and so you just feel badly, of course, feel badly that you lost a friend, but that's part of it. Tomorrow it could be you. You eat dinner, you go to bed, you get up and have breakfast, and you do it again.
And I guess I didn't ask you, that's three out of how many? How many Corsair pilots did you have on there?
Probably 16.
That's it. So three out of the 16 guys on your very first mission don't come back. Do you have a count of how many missions you flew over there?
Oh, yeah. If I remember right, it was about 60.
Over the stretch of?
Well, we were on the Essex for 10 months, but we were not in combat for the whole 10 months.
Right.
We'd be in combat, then the ship would pull back and refuel and rearm, and you'd have, in effect, a day off. But you still, some of you would fly combat air patrol over the ship most every day.
Just to be ready in case kamikazes came in?
Or any Japanese.
Sure. I feel like I'm barely scratching the surface of what you went through, especially if you had 60 missions. There have to be some instances that stand out along the way where you came close, where it could have been you.
No, you don't even think about it when you get back.
Some landings on that carrier that were less than normal?
There was lots of landings that were not normal, but I never had. Every one is a controlled crash. I mean, it's not a crash in that it bangs up the airplane, but it's, if you don't do it just right, you're going to have a problem. And when you caught a wire, if you caught with your hook, that cable actually would stop you, the hook. But if you got too near the edge and you caught the cable, it'd just throw you over the side, or you were going to have some kind of a crash. And once in a while, the plane would not catch a hook, and they've lost too much power. They're coming down. They pulled the throttle off, so it's just idling. And across the ship, they had big arms that would come up about 5 feet high or 6 feet high, something like that, with cable across. And that would keep you from crashing into the planes that were on the front of the deck, because we didn't have the slanted deck
right
that they have now.
It's a flat top.
This is just one deck. So when I land, I taxi in front of these, let these cables down. I taxi over them in the front of the plane, and they raise it up for the next guy coming in, landing behind me. And if he doesn't catch a wire, those cables will stop him most all the time. If he really floats high, he would go over the cables and crash into the planes in the front, and then you have a real mess.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen too often. Those cables usually stop you.
What's the hairiest landing that you remember?
I had a 1,000-pound bomb that I couldn't get rid of.
Uh-oh.
I couldn't get it off.
It's armed?
Well, the bomb is safe until the fuse arms it.
Right.
The bomb, you can drop it 1,000 feet, nothing's going to happen. It's just going to bounce.
Uh-huh.
But there's a little propeller or impeller that arms the fuse that's been put in the front of the bomb. And once that happens, the bomb is live. But there's a safety wire in there that, as long as it will come off when you drop the bomb.
Right.
Well, if you don't drop the bomb, the safety wire is still there. Anyway, I couldn't get rid of this bomb. I couldn't get it off.
You had tried to release it, didn't you? Probably shook the wings a little bit.
Did all kinds of maneuvers trying to shake it loose. I couldn't. So last resort, you come in with the bomb on, and I caught a wire and stopped. I saw everybody's head went down. Well, if the bomb had gone off, putting their heads down wouldn't have done any good, and I'd have been blown up.
You'd be in a million pieces.
But the bomb hit the propeller. It came off when I caught the wire, landed on the deck, and nothing happened.
So you come in, you catch the wire, the bomb pops off, slides across the deck, and everybody's ducking, waiting for it to explode.
Yeah, but it wouldn't. If it was going to explode, ducking wouldn't have made you,
right.
It would have been too late.
But were you sure it wasn't going to explode?
Well, I didn't know. There was nothing I could do about it. I'm sitting in the cockpit. I realized when everybody started ducking, and I heard the propeller hit the bomb. It was just a tick.
Yeah.
But anyway, nothing happened. It didn't explode, obviously.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic. You're the one who lived through it, and I know you're very humble about everything you did, and you're making it sound like no big deal. But by this point, you've tried everything you can to get rid of this sucker. You probably exhausted all your fuel, and that's why you have to land finally?
Well, I'm getting pretty low, yeah. But
this has been building to this point this whole time, and now you're finally bringing it in, and it's literally do or die, right?
Right.
So what goes through your mind as you're approaching that carrier?
Just do my thing. And if I couldn't get rid of it, it's probably going to stay on. Well, it didn't stay on. It came off. And it happened with other people with rockets, which we carried a 5-inch rocket under our wings. And one of them wouldn't fire off. And you'd come in and land, and the rocket would come off, and sometimes they exploded. There's a 5-inch shell on the front of I never had one of my rockets hang up.
I'm sure you had some rough weather that you had to try to take off and land in also.
Oh, yes, it's almost humorous. In this bad weather, there's always a 2-plane standby on the catapults, and you're sitting in that plane for a while, and somebody else will sit in it some more. And the weather was terrible. You couldn't see, but the ship move around and the weather would be a little spotty. At one point, the 900-foot-long flight deck You couldn't see from the front to the back or the back to the front. It was that bad, but they did get a little bit better. Well, radar said there was a bogey out there. I don't know why any self-respecting Japanese pilot would be out there flying around and that stuff. But so they fired us off, the two of us off, and started vectoring us around. We couldn't see one if he was across the street from us.
Wow.
And we were in the cloud. And we vectored us here and vectored us there and vectored us around. We kept telling them we can't see anything, but we were doing what we were told. Anyway, they finally brought us right in over the destroyer that was running the radar, and they started shooting at us. They're looking at us on the radar.
So they're shooting based on that with no visual contact.
And we told them on the radio what what the scoop was.
I'm sure that was a nice, clean, calm conversation.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, they stopped shooting and they didn't hit us. But we were up about 3 hours on that flight and we never saw anything. And there was no bogey. There was no Japanese out there. And if there was, we couldn't have seen him.
Yeah, and really, you put your lives at stake for no reason, it sounds like.
Basically, well, that's the way it goes. Those are the things that happen. Like I said, it's almost laughable. All this effort and nothing.
Yeah.
But you never know.
And you never know where these conversations are going to take us. You definitely don't want to miss the rest of Walt Burr's story. I'll read you his Distinguished Flying Cross citation when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing now with 92-year-old Walt Burr of Merced, California, a Navy fighter pilot credited with 2 confirmed kills while flying off the carrier USS Essex with VBF 83, bombing and strafing Japanese positions in the Pacific for the last 6 months of World War II. The air groups aboard the Essex would receive the Presidential Unit Citation for their work throughout the war, and Walt was recognized with the Distinguished Flying Cross.
The President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Distinguished Flying Cross to Ensign Walter E. Burr, United States Naval Reserve, for heroism and extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flights and operations against the enemy in the vicinity of Nansei, Shoto, and Kyushu, Japan, as pilot of a carrier-based plane during the period of 18 March 1945 to 24 May 1945. He participated in 20 strikes against enemy shipping, airfields, and installations, inflicting extensive damage. His skill and courage were at all times inspiring and in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. So they gave you that DFC with those flowery words. Did that mean something to you?
Well, yeah, you appreciated it, but you just were doing your job. You were doing what you enlisted to do, and at least they recognized that you were doing what you were supposed to be doing.
Well, I think this goes a little beyond that. Heroism, extraordinary achievement, his skill and courage were at all times inspiring and in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. Sounds like they're saying if you didn't do your job as well as you did it, that things could have turned out differently.
Oh, yes.
What were some of the missions where it became clearest to you that if things hadn't gone exactly the way they went, you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me right now?
Well, I think of one in particular that was unusual. We took off in clear weather, but there was a front between the fleet and Okinawa, and our mission was to go to Okinawa, bomb it, and do some damage. The leader of our Corsair group led us into the front in a turn. Well, I just kept turning and came back out of the front and figured everybody. And when I came back out to where we had gone in, I'm all by myself. So I turned around, went back in the front, and started climbing. It can fly in the clouds, that's no problem. But I'm heading towards Okinawa. I didn't know what else to do, and I didn't know where anybody was. I finally came out on top of the front, and I was up at about 35,000 feet. Beautiful blue sky, nobody around. You maintain radio silence. I don't call up and say, where is everybody? I just assume they're, well, I don't know where they are. But anyway, I look around and down behind me, there's a flight of Corsairs. They got on the radio saying, bogey, 12 o'clock high, and the bogey is me. Well, that was a group from another carrier, and they were all together and going to Okinawa. So we communicated, and they came up and looked me over to see if I was a real, not a Japanese in a Corsair. Anyway, I joined up with them, and we went on to Okinawa. Well, Okinawa was socked in. We did our best to bomb whatever we could bomb, and I flew with them through all this and then back to the fleet. When we got back to the fleet, why, the whole group of ships turned into the wind so you could land. I landed on the Essex. The air group commander, the captain of the ship, called and ordered me up to bridge, because I was the only one from the Essex that got to Okinawa that day, and not that I did anything, only had one hole in the plane. Somebody must have fired from somebody on the ground on Okinawa. But anyway, I got up to the bridge and gave him my report, and that's all there was to it. Well, I could have gone back to the ship where everybody else went back and landed. None of them went to Okinawa from the Essex that day.
All the other Corsairs had come back to the Essex.
Yeah, and I could have gone back, but I didn't know. We were maintaining radio silence. It did what I thought I should do. I would have gotten to Okinawa all by myself and done it and gone back home, you know. But that, you didn't really want to be out there flying around by yourself, you know.
Yeah. Did that put a little lump in your throat when you realized that none of the other guys had ever gone?
Well, not by then, but it did when I first came back out of the clouds and saw that nobody was around. I said, what do I do now? Well,
yeah.
What I thought I should do is what I did.
Well, and a lot of things come to mind on that. I mean, A, you hear them calling out bogey and you know it's you, and if they had acted too fast, they could have shot you down.
Oh, yeah, but
And what if you never encountered those guys? Well, what if you had gone by yourself?
Well,
you would have been in a more dangerous position,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. By that time, I was pretty much on my way to Okinawa.
And you mentioned you only had one hole in your plane.
Yeah.
Of all those missions you flew, how frequent was that you would end up with some holes in that Corsair?
Very seldom.
Did you ever feel them when they happened?
Yeah, you could hear them.
You act like this isn't a big deal. This is your life.
Yeah.
You're a 20-year-old kid?
I'm not even that yet. I can't vote. Can't buy a drink.
Uh-huh.
But at that age, you think you're going to live forever. Whatever's going to happen, not going to happen to me. It's going to happen to the other guy.
Uh-huh.
And it does happen to the other guy. If you get back home, it didn't happen to you.
That's true. But you also have a lot of examples where you almost were that other guy.
Well, yeah.
And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that you mentioned Okinawa and your group was very prolific during the assault on Okinawa. Wasn't there a situation there where there was a position that you were supposed to hit that was really tricky to hit on the side of a mountain or something like that? Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
Tell me what's that whole story?
Well, when you're supplying ground support to the Marines or the Army, but in this case the Marines, we would go with bombs or rockets and or rockets, and sometimes with napalm, you would go and do your strafing or dropping your bombs, aiming away from our troops, not towards them. Well, there was a situation that they wanted us to drop towards them. They couldn't dislodge the Japanese from these caves and tunnels or whatever they were in, I don't know. And we did. The danger of overshooting and hitting our own guys was great when you do that.
Uh-huh.
So you don't do that if you possibly can avoid it. In this situation, they said, oh, try it. So we did, and we didn't hit them. And we went pretty low before we dropped stuff, because we wanted to be darn sure we hit what we were aiming at and didn't overshoot. We didn't overshoot. We did it.
So what you're saying is if you're not accurate, it's going to cost American lives.
Yeah, right.
And so this was like a cave or a position the Japanese had on the side of a hill?
Right.
So you go super low. I mean, it almost sounds like it has to be the perfect shot. You're releasing a bomb that has to kind of slide into this cave?
Yeah, so apparently bombs needed to be able to do damage in the cave instead of the other side of the hill, which is just hill, rock, whatever.
So the margin for error is pretty much zero.
Pretty much zero.
Yeah.
And if you go the other way, over your friendlies towards the enemy, that's the normal way of doing it.
Right.
And if you overshoot, it's no big deal.
But you couldn't do that in this situation.
Right.
Because of the topography.
Yeah, I guess. They had the problem and they took it to us and said, can you do this? And we said, yeah, we can do it.
Even though you'd never done it before.
Right, well,
never trained for that kind of shot.
No. Well, but you knew what we needed to do and we were able to do it.
Is that one of those where there's some relief afterwards?
Oh, yeah. Great relief to know that. Because we really can't be positive that we succeeded. You know, you don't get out of your car and look and see what you did to your bumper. You know, this all happens fast, and you get out of there. And the report was great. I'll tell you kind of a humorous situation.
All right.
We're hitting a naval base on the very northeast tip of Honshu, which is the main Japanese island, and there's a peninsula of land that comes out and forms a bay, and out on the end of, near the end of this peninsula is a Japanese naval base, and we're going to hit that because close to the northern part of Honshu, the northernmost island is Hokkaido, and there were six railroad ferries. There was no bridge or tunnel or anything. With the naval base there, it needed to be knocked down and slowed down and stuff because we wanted to go hit these ferries. So we hit the naval base and we lose, I guess, one or two dive bombers. But one of our Corsair pilots gets shot up and lands in this bay. But he's far enough away from the naval base, they don't realize that he has gone down. Or if they do, they have ignored it. He gets out of this plane, goes on the shore. On the peninsula, there's nothing but scrub trees and brush and stuff. There's no buildings, but there's a railroad line, and this is late in the day, and we are over him. We see that he's all right, but we don't circle or anything because that would tell the Japanese that somebody is alive down there.
Yeah.
But we know he's all right. There isn't time to get the OS-2U seaplane to fly out from a battleship or cruiser to land to pick him up. So we have to go back to the fleet. We do. We're back over him at dawn the next day, and he comes out of the brush, and he waved to us. His name is Vern Coombe, and he's all right. He's fine. and we get the OS2U out there. It lands in the bay, and there's pretty good surf, wind blowing, and the OS2U is on pontoons, sits up in the air pretty high, so Kumbi in the water, no way could he reach up, and he needs help to get on. So the pilot gets partway out of the cockpit and on the wing and throw him a rope, or whatever happened, the pilot fell into the water and hit the throttle, and the plane taxis out into the bay. Now you got two guys there. They got life preservers on. Kumbi had his raft, even his rubber raft, you know.
So the plane got away from them. They're not tailing behind the plane. They're just floating in the water.
Right. They get another OS2U out there.
And the Japanese still haven't seen them.
They apparently didn't realize that they were there. So another plane comes, and that guy rescues both pilots and takes off. And by that time now, the Japanese are shooting at them, but not hitting them, apparently. They got it out. Well, now what do you do with the plane that's taxiing out on the water? And the head folks tell us they'll sink it. So we started shooting at it. We shot a little bit, and we were hitting the fuselage fine, but that wasn't sinking it. That dawned on us we need to shoot at the pontoons, which we did and sunk it. But the laughable deal is the pilot falling out of his plane. It all turned out fine. Nobody was hurt.
And for folks who might be saying, well, why'd you have to shoot your own plane? Well, you don't want the Japanese getting a hold of it.
Exactly right. And there's no other way to do it.
Well, I've never met a Corsair pilot who shot down an OS2U before. Yeah. So there you go.
There you go. Well, it was already down, but we sunk it.
Yeah, sunk a seaplane. But you don't want to put an American flag under your cockpit Corsair.
No. We were just tickled to death that it all turned out.
With the dropping of the bombs in August of 45, hastening the end of the war, you know, a lot of guys have told me they really believe that spared their life.
Oh, I firmly believe that, because, all right, they dropped the bombs at the end of the war, but the plan, we weren't coming home. We were going to be part of the invasion.
And you've already been bombing and strafing Japan.
Oh, yeah.
But now troops are going to come ashore. You're going to be flying more of those missions, and the opposition would have been...
The Japanese were going to put up a very stiff resistance. And if you got shot down, you might survive the plane crash, but the Japanese would have killed you in a minute, you know.
They weren't going to be taking any prisoners anymore.
No.
Not that they treated their prisoners well to begin with.
Oh, God, no. No.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for giving us a little taste of what it was like to be a Corsair pilot. I know almost a couple of years ago now, you had a chance to go back to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You had to fly off an old Air Force base. I don't know if that was, you know, if that stoked the rivalry between the Navy pilots and the Air Force pilots.
Yeah.
To go from Castle here in your backyard to Washington, D.C., see the World War II Memorial and all those other sites with a bunch of other veterans. What was that experience like? What did it mean to you?
It meant a great deal. It meant a lot of people saying thank you by contributing the money that made it possible, plus the dedicated folks that made it all physically possible. They were wonderful. You didn't do what you did expecting wonderful treatment like that, but it was nice when it happened. Mm. It was nice to think that the hundreds of people that donated money and the dozens of people who donated their time and probably money to make all that happen 70 years later.
Well, I think it's an acknowledgement that we know we wouldn't be here without what you and all those other guys did. And I'm just interested too, since the driving force behind the Honor Flight movement is to let guys like you see in person the memorial built in your honor and the honor of those who didn't come home. So when you're there at that World War II memorial and there's that wall of gold stars, what were you thinking about while you were there?
The guys that didn't come home. I had a roommate when we were on Maui in training. He was up on a training flight and had a mid-air collision, was killed. That was pretty personal. I was able to, we came in at the end of the war to Seattle. It so happens that Harold Habeneck was from Seattle. He was my roommate there in Hawaii. I was able to go see his folks and did. And we communicated up until the time they passed away.
That must have meant the world to them.
Yeah.
To hear from you.
And it was something I could do and did.
And I'm sure there's so much more you did that we didn't hear about. Walt Burr, 92 years young. We're out of time here on the radio. I do have a few more of Mr. Burr's stories in the extended podcast version accessible at hometownheroesradio.com, including how he met his wife when he returned to Rutgers after the war. Not surprisingly, Walt says he'd take an F4U Corsair over a Mustang, but next time we're going to hear the other side of that debate from a P-51 pilot turned POW turned football coach. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
I guess I didn't ask you that question because the whole design of the Corsair is to have fighter capabilities, and if you are attacked by enemy fighters, that you can engage in those situations. Is that something that you ever ended up having to do, fly head-to-head with other fighters?
Well, some of us did. Near the end of the war, we did not have much of a chance to get into. There weren't hardly any Japanese around. I got two.
Two confirmed kills?
Yeah. Some of our guys got a lot more, but it depended on where you got sent and what you were supposed to do.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be nice to be able to say you shot down a bunch of them, and some of the guys did, but that was really the epitome of what you did as a fighter pilot. You wanted to shoot down another plane,
right,
or planes. But you had to find them first.
Were those Zeros? Are they bigger planes? Or?
No, they were fighter planes, but yeah. I think one was a Nick and a Nick.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the other one was. I really don't. I could go look it up in my logbook, but.
And was there any doubt that you were going to be the one that shot him down as opposed to the other way around?
No, I was going to get the... They both were sitting ducks, I think you might say. They were either taking off or landing. They were not in a favorable position, let's put it that way. A couple of missions that we flew were what they call rescue cap. There would be American submarines off the coast of Japan to pick up downed pilots, not only Navy, but Air Force, P-51s that flew from Iwo to protect the B-29s. We knew how to navigate. We knew how to get back home, but the Air Force, a lot of these guys didn't know how to navigate over water. Mm-hmm. They could read a map and figure out, but flying that 700 miles over water is a different story.
Yeah.
But there was another way they could go after we had taken Okinawa. They could fly it, but they didn't know how to do that. So when they go down, or if they went down, Navy provided this rescue cap. We'd go out, and a couple of us at a time. If there was a submarine down there, submarine wouldn't surface till the rescue cap was over them.
So you're providing cover so they can actually carry out the rescue.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they wouldn't come up until we got over them. We could talk to them. They would be afraid to come up because some yokel would decide that it was a Jap.
Right.
You know, they were vulnerable to being hit, so we'd go over them. Well, you had the opportunity to save some people that way. And there was one situation where two of us were over the sub in just the northeast corner of Kyushu. It was some little bay there. Somebody, I don't know whether it was an Air Force or Navy pilot, but there was a guy in the water. And he was practically in the bay, in this bay. And so it was very shallow. The submarine captain, whoever he was, he had lots of guts. He wouldn't go into the bay unless we could provide some cover for him. And there was anti-aircraft guns there all over Japan. They were there. But he said, if you can give me cover, he's talking to the two of us. He says, I'll try to get him out. And so we set up a round robin where we were circling and firing our 50s to suppress the fire for... that they would be shooting at the submarine because they could hit it and puncture. Yeah.
And if they do, then you're basically trading a whole bunch of lives for the one you're trying to save.
Right.
Right.
But so we set up this round robin and suppressed them enough, and that guy went in. He didn't surface all the way, but he couldn't submerge and come up. He was down in the water, submarine-wise, and he went in and got whoever the poor guy was, and I never did know who the guy was that was rescued, but he went in there and got him and got out.
But what stood out to you was the courage of that submarine captain.
Oh, yes.
To take that boat into those shallow waters and risk pretty much his whole crew.
Yeah. And they didn't think twice about it. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really have a chance for those aircraft guns. They couldn't concentrate on the submarine because we were making them keep their heads down. We just didn't shoot all the time because you'd shoot up all your ammunition.
You might run out of time.
You put a little squirt out and go. But anyway, that was a interesting kind of hairy time.
Yeah. Well, listening to you talk about the courage of that submarine commander makes me wonder how you would describe the guys you flew with. Your impressions of them and what kind of courage or selflessness or chutzpah it took for them to do what they did every day.
Well, we were only risking ourselves. And if you're going to take on that honor of Navy fighter pilot, you're going to do what you got to do. And you don't give it too much thought. You just do it. At least we could... Like flying our round robin, sure, we could get shot down easily enough. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot easier than the Japs could sink the sub, but we just did it. Mm-hmm. We don't sit there and say, well, that's dangerous. You just do it. Mm-hmm. That your whole mental thing is positive. Let me put it this way. If you did start thinking in that negative sense, you wouldn't be any good. Because you wouldn't do whatever you needed to do.
And you might get yourself killed.
Yeah. Well, you might get yourself killed doing what you're supposed to be doing, but that's what, you just did it.
Mm-hmm. What was it like to see your folks again? Here, you're their only child. You're off here a world away, putting your life at risk, and then you make it home. What was that reunion like?
Very, very touching. But the war was over. Let's get back to college, and life goes on.
Well, and it's a good thing you went back to college at Rutgers.
Oh, yes.
Because if you didn't, you wouldn't have met your wife.
Right. That was back in the fraternity that I had been in before the war, and one of my fraternity brothers, bless his heart, he'd had polio, and he was all crippled up, but he had a good spirit, and he was talking to his girlfriend over at the New Jersey College for Women on the other side of New Brunswick from what was the main campus of Rutgers at the time. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to fix me up with a date. And I said, I'm busy. I was taking night school and summer school and the regular curriculum on top of it. I was carrying a pretty good load of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think about going out with gals at the time. I was just too loaded. Anyway, the gal who I married was a freshman, and my buddy on the phone, apparently the gal he was talking to, said that, well, she's a freshman to me, and the other end heard the conversation, and my wife spoke up and said, well, what's wrong with a freshman, you know? And I said, hey, I didn't say that. There's nothing wrong with a freshman. Let's go. And
blind date.
Yeah.
Never seen her before.
No. Apparently hit it off quite well, because 66 years. And we lived, well, I've lived here 33 years. Uh-huh. She passed away in 2014, so, but we lived here for all the 31 years,
yeah,
here, but and we did a lot of things, and things that I now wish I had done a lot more. Little things. You know, I fix my meals now, or a lot of them. And, well, I put this morning, the light in the refrigerator went out, and I changed it. Well, I'd have done that when she was alive, too. But a lot of the things that I now do, she did. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize how much detail she did that I just took for granted. Mm-hmm. And I've scolded myself for a lot of the things that I should have done and could have done, little things. Mm. You know, we obviously didn't fight or anything like that, but there was things I could have done and should have done that I regret not doing now, but I took for granted then.
Well, those are good words for a lot of us husbands to hear. Not to take our wives for granted or all the things they do.
But it's too late after she's gone. I can't even tell her I wish I had done all those things.
I think she knows. And I'm sure she had some regrets too.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing that, well, it's a very personal thing, but the day she died, she was out of it. She was on, they had her on drugs, and she was in bad shape. And I was there holding her hand and talking with to her, but I didn't know whether she was even knew that I was there. She was really gone, you know, but she was still alive. And I reached up, she was in bed, and leaned over and kissed her. And she kissed me back. I haven't, you're the only person I've ever told that to.
Wow.
You could tell it tears me up now.
Well, and I, only you know, but just seeing the expression on your face and hearing you describe that, it sounds like, especially with how unexpected that was, how unresponsive she had been, that that probably meant more to you than anything she could have said.
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. Well, sorry.
No. Those are the things that matter. Thank you for sharing that with me. You proud of what you did in war?
Oh, yeah. I wish I could have done more. I did all that I could do at the time that I was doing it.
What would you rather fly, an F-4U or a P-51?
Well, I never flew the 51, but I'll take the Corsair. They were about equal. Yeah. I flew mock dogfights with 51s when I was in Hawaii.
Yeah.
I'm glad the Japanese didn't have the 51s. But Corsair was we could outturn them because we could put down some of our flap, not the whole flap, put down 40 degrees, no. But I'm in at high speed. I could put down 10 or 20, and it allowed me to turn much tighter.
Mm-hmm.
They had more range, but we had range with belly tanks.
Sure.
That was equivalent to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both good airplanes.